Okay, good evening, everybody. Our topic for tonight is American Jewry and World War One. This World War One was the war to end all wars, or at least it was supposed to be. It was the war to make the world safe for democracy, or at least it was supposed to be. So World War One gets a bum rap, and deservedly so. It was a horrible war in every way. But what was the impact of the war on the American Jewish experience? So I want to examine this from the perspective of the home front, those who were fighting in the army, and the political perspective. What was the attitude of American Jewry, if you could say there was one such attitude, towards whether we should fight the war at all, whether it was pro this side or pro that side or neutral or pacifist? What were the attitudes of American Jews about going to war? So first, on the issue of family life and the home front, World War One disrupted Jewish family life on a global scale. There was no immigration during the war from 1914 to 1918, which meant that the great wave of Jewish immigration to the United States, which had lasted about 34 years from 1881 to 1914, came to an abrupt end. And nobody anticipated that this was going to happen, which means that people who were moving in 1910, 11, 12, 13, 14, and thought they could bring other family members with them in the near future, all of a sudden realized, wow, I can't. And now you have a segmented family. And the prolonged duration of the segmented family had disastrous consequences for these people. I mean, it was typical. One second. Can everyone hear me or no? One second. I hear someone says they can't hear me.
Your audio is fine.
Audio is fine.
No problem.
No problem.
I hear
okay.
You now.
All right. Good, good. That's good to know. So it was often the case that a father would go first from Europe to the United States, and sometimes with young children, with older children, teenage children, and a wife would stay back in Europe with young children until such time as passage was afforded, you could have the money to actually bring everybody over. So for those who came to the United States in the handful of years before 1914, there might have been family members back in Europe who were waiting to come to America, but now they can't come. So you have to wait and wait and wait. And then even after 1918, when the war is over, well, the war isn't really over, because where do Jews live? Mostly in Eastern Europe. What happens in Eastern Europe after World War One? The answer is ongoing war. There's a Russian Revolution. There's a Russian Civil War. Poland, Ukraine, Belarus are all affected by it. And so Jews who live in the heartland of Ashkenazic Eastern European Jewish life, they're still stuck for a little while longer. So sometimes these families with half the family in America and half the family in Europe were apart for 10, 12 years. And what ends up happening is finally when the rest of the family members arrive on the American shores, the person you knew from beforehand is not the same person you know now. So the wife that you left behind is not the same person 10 years later, but rather has been, you know, grizzled by time experiencing the war without a spouse. And for that matter, from the perspective of the Europeans who are coming, they see an American Jew. Well, Chaim had payas and a shtreimel when I last saw him 10 years ago, and now he looks like a goy. So these things happen to people, and the Jewish social workers in the 1920s recognized that many families basically were devastated and couldn't get along with each other. There was dissent and dissension in the family. A kid was a toddler when he last saw his father back in Russia in 1913, is now a teenager and rebels against his father. So it was really bad for family life. World War One was a decisive factor in leading the United States to adopt immigration restrictions. It was the sort of the straw that broke the camel's back. People, sentiment in the United States among so-called Native Americans, not Indians, but what we might call Native Americans, was let's not have too much immigration anymore. It's not good. And World War One showed that Europe was a balkanized society where everyone has an identity which is overly nationalistic or linguistic or cultural, and such people are unable to jettison those identities and blend harmoniously in a place like America. So if we don't want to see the balkanization of the United States like we saw the balkanization of Europe, then the best thing to do is keep people out, don't let people in, And so there was increased pressure politically in the Congress for legislative measures. And in 1917, you have the first such measure, which required a literacy test for any European coming to America over the age of 14. Now, granted, most Jews were literate, so it really didn't affect them all that badly. But still, this was foreshadowing what would happen in 1921 and 1924, the Johnson Reed Act. Okay, so we're going to spend probably a whole session on this, maybe next week, actually, on issues of restrictions on immigration. But just suffice it to say that it was becoming increasingly difficult to get to America after the war, and people needed to get in because they had family members who were waiting for them. Okay. American Jews experienced World War I very differently than Jews everywhere else in the world. All other Jews, or almost all other Jews, were in a combat zone, were in a war zone, with forces going back and forth, occupation, brutal occupation, potential liberation, turns out to not be liberation, but just another occupation. So people who lived elsewhere, especially in Europe, but not just in Europe, even in Asia, in Eretz Israel, even without moving, even by staying in literally the same place the whole time, you were now under new jurisdiction. So what comes to be after World War I? British Mandate of Palestine instead of the Ottoman Empire. Poland instead of the other great powers of Europe. Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, Czechoslovakia. All these places never existed before. I mean, the physical location was there, but these jurisdictions didn't exist. So the collapse of all the old world empires, the monarchies and the dictatorships, led to the rise of new nation states. So this didn't happen to American Jews. If you lived in Brooklyn in 1914, well, it was still Brooklyn in 1918. Nothing changed other than the trolley Dodgers now became the Dodgers. That was about it. So this was a different experience. American Jews had stability. Jews everywhere else had instability in terms of economic life and political life. Okay. Well, American Jewry, Eli's asking what type of test for literacy. It was not English. It was any language, your own language. They couldn't expect people who arrived to know English yet that they would learn when they get here. Okay. So American Jewry became the world power broker in matters of world Jewish politics. That previously, America had been a Jewish backwater. Yes, it was a place where you went to from Europe if you were escaping persecution, and a growing number of Jews were moving to America, fine. But when it came to the machers and the big heavyweights of world Jewry, so that was Europe, that was Germany, France, England. America was a second-rate backwater. Well, not so anymore. World War I changes that. Now American Jewry becomes the dominant Jewish community, politically and economically, and they'll throw their weight around accordingly. So one of the things that happens in World War I that proves this point is the need for assistance, for material assistance. It used to be that the Hilfsverein in Germany or the Alliance in France or British Jewish organizations could carry the burden, shoulder the burden of Jewish philanthropy. Well, not so anymore. Now it's the Joint Distribution Committee in America that is going to send the kesef and the supplies elsewhere to save beleaguered Jews who are refugees in bad parts of the world. So the Joint Jewish Distribution Committee was called the Joint because it was a combination of a bunch of different groups that were acting independently in 1914, but got together by 1915 for a common purpose. Now, these included the old American Jewish Committee, our crowd types, the German Jews, the wealthy ones. It included the Landsmannschaften, who were the rank and file Eastern European Jews downtown, including the socialists. It included the Orthodox and the Zionists. So all these four different groups that were oftentimes at loggerheads and were various factions within American Jewish community, they were able to get together for philanthropic purposes. Sometimes that's the only reason why you can get together, is to give charity, to give tzedakah to somebody else in need. But it should be noted that American Jews didn't trust European Jews to run the joint. They had, when a field office was opened up in Paris, American Jewry sent American Jews to run that office and did not rely upon French Jews. So this is another example where American Jewry is coming to dominate world Jewish affairs. Where did most of the money go? Most of the money went to the Pale of Settlement, or what was now the former Pale of Settlement, and a portion of it went to Eretz Yisrael. Okay, well, another thing that would happen is that the Landsmannschaften would send care packages and money back to their hometown. So the Bialystok group would send money to Bialystok. The Lvov group would send money to Lvov. Okay, the Tarno group would send money to Tarno, and so on and so forth. Why did they do this? Because they cared about their brethren that they knew from before the war. But also, American Jews had an agenda of trying to modernize European Jewry. So by sending representatives who looked westernized, looked Americanized, and would offer advice about how to spend this money and how to reorganize your community, the intention was, on the part of American Jews, to influence their old countrymen back home to behave more like them, to get rid of their old world ways and become modern Jews. Okay, there was a political gap among American Jews, and we're going to spend a lot of time on this, but just a few points now. Some Jews were pro-German. Why? Because they were pro the Central Powers and anti the Allies. Why? Because they loved the Austro-Hungarian Empire. You know, Franz Joseph I was seen as a hero by many Jews. They had a picture of him on their wall. You know, many Jews in Vienna, even in Galicia, and even in the United States who had come from these places saw Franz Josef as a great man, a liberator, an emancipator. So why not fight for his team as opposed to fighting for the Russians? Who would want to fight for the Tsar? The Tsar is the devil. Nicholas II, the Romanov dynasty, are terrible. Haters of the Jews, the worst vicious anti-Semites. So you have a reason now to be affirmatively pro-Central Power and anti the Allies, because we like Austria, we don't like Russia. At least for some Jews, that was the case. The Zionists also had an interest in these things, but it was in the other direction, to be pro-British, because the British would oust the Ottomans from Eretz Israel, which could lead to the flowering of Jewish statehood. So you know, Jews could go in either direction, but then there's a third direction, and that is pacifism. What kind of Jews were pacifists? So the anarchists, the socialists, those who were ideologically pacifist in all circumstances, not just in this war. And they claimed that what? That it was capitalist greed that was leading the world to war, that in every country it was the capitalists who wanted to go fight, and that the working class were the cannon fodder that was going to die on the battlefield. So therefore, the right thing to do, said these kind of Jews, is to oppose the war. Now, they could afford to do that because America was neutral, at least in the early phases of the war. So this position was consistent with the American government. But that changes. Eventually, America does join the war in April 1917. So when that happens, if you're a socialist and you live in New York, and now the government says we're going to war, and you are still ideologically opposed to warfare, you're a little bit on the outs. So, for example, in 1917... there was a mayoral race, which I mentioned once before, and Morris Hillquit ran for mayor of New York City as a socialist, and he didn't do that badly, but he didn't win. But he continued to oppose America's entry into the war even after it was announced. Meyer London, who was in Congress, voted against going to war. He, together with 50 other congressmen, voted against going to war. Meyer London also opposed the Espionage Act of 1917 and the Sedition Act of 1918. And some American Jews were tried under the Sedition Act. So, for example, Emma Goldman, who was known as the most dangerous woman in America, that's a nice appellation, was arrested and sentenced to 2 years in jail for her seditious anti-war writings. Also, Congressman Victor Berger of Milwaukee was a Jewish congressman from Milwaukee. He was sentenced to 20 years in jail as a sitting congressman, all right, for sedition. Now, his conviction was overturned by the courts, by the appellate courts in 1921. But can you imagine a sitting congressman being sentenced to jail for sedition? Well, maybe nowadays that's not so unbelievable. But, you know, it happened, okay? So most American Jews... participated in the war effort like all other Americans, in buying liberty bonds, in agreeing to whatever austerity measures were in place, and in sending their boys off to war. 200 to 250,000 American Jews were in uniform. It was 5% of the total army. Well, that was a disproportionate number because Jews were only about 3% or less of the total population, maybe 2.5%. So why were they 5% of the army? It was not out of super duper hyper patriotism. Let's get that out of the way. It was not because of hyper patriotism. It was a simple fact of demography. American Jews were younger than everybody else or the rest of the population because American Jews were recent immigrants and people came usually male and usually young. And so therefore, if you're 18, 19, 20, 21 years old, you're subject to the draft when the draft was in place between May of 17 and November of 18. So they got called in. The U.S. government realized that they had to solicit Jewish involvement in the war effort with some kind of propaganda. That propaganda included flyers and pamphlets and brochures printed in Yiddish. You know, the famous picture of Uncle Sam pointing a finger and says, "Uncle Sam wants you for the army." So they had those in Yiddish too, and other such material. Why Yiddish? Well, the answer is every immigrant group was targeted. They printed such things in Italian, and they printed such things in Spanish. They printed such things even in German. Okay, so every immigrant group was being targeted for participation in the war effort, Jews included. There was the American Jewish Committee started a Bureau of Statistics to prove that Jews really were fighting. You know, there's always going to be the accusation that Jews are cowardly and they're not participating in the war effort, that they're shirking their responsibilities. This accusation was leveled against the Jews of Germany in 1916 and led to the Judenzahlen, the Jewish census, which was designed by the anti-Semites to prove that the Jews were not really fighting. What the evidence actually showed was the Jews were disproportionately fighting, so they buried the evidence. But in America, the government didn't do that because the government here in America is not as bigoted as the German government was. So the American Jewish Committee did it on its own just to prove the point that our guys were fighting together with everyone else. Okay. Now, during the war, Judaism as a religion was given recognition. The Secretary of War created a new type of chaplaincy for Protestants, Catholics, and Jews. And the question is, who would take over the chaplaincy on behalf of the Jewish people? So for the Protestants, it was a YMCA organization. For the Catholics, it was the Knights of Columbus. But for the Jews, who was it going to be? So in order to fill this void, the Jewish Welfare Board was established. It created an institutional structure that could create a Jewish chaplaincy and provide services to Jewish soldiers under Jewish auspices. It was a new body within the American Jewish community. For the first time, Jews and Gentiles would have to interact and cooperate in close quarters. Now, this happened during the Civil War, but the Civil War, there was a limited number of Jews in the country and a limited number of Jews in the army, and it was a civil war. It was not overseas. This is the first time that Jews in very large numbers are interacting all over the place, all over the world, as American soldiers together with American Gentiles. And the question was, should there be separate Jewish facilities and programs, leisure time programs for soldiers in the army? Many of these new American Jewish soldiers were new immigrants who didn't even speak English. There was a need to teach them English. So this machlokus among the Jewish Welfare Board about how to deal with this led to two different schools of thought. One said, you know, total integration. And the other said, well, we have to give people something under their own auspices, otherwise they'll feel uncomfortable. At military camps, what sometimes would happen is there'd be Jews davening in a minyan with a bacher, with a talis over his head, leading mincha and mariv, okay? And the Gentile soldiers would be sitting around the periphery of this room, smoking and schmoozing and talking sports, but they were watching the Jews daven because it was one barracks in one social hall area. And so they sometimes developed a curiosity, sometimes an animosity, but in any event, there was this interaction. Okay, so Jews learned what united them with other Americans and also what divided them. There was an element of discrimination, there sure was. In another direction, Gentiles found out that Jews don't have horns and tails and that not all Jews are fabulously wealthy, or for that matter, not all Jews are crooks. You know, there were certain prejudices and stereotypes that had to be overcome, which were overcome in the army, because it turned out that Jews really aren't all that horrible or don't exhibit the kinds of horrific features that the most bigoted of Gentiles would think of us. Okay, the clergy of different denominations learned to work together. sometimes the clergy had to minister to soldiers of other faiths. So a Jew has to minister to a Catholic or to a Protestant, or a Catholic has to minister to a Jew. And there was an example of a Catholic priest having to leave Purim services and have a Jew read the Megillah in Purim of 1918. All right, these bizarre things happen like that. Another thing that happened was Jews who came from New York, New York Jews, all right, they didn't know too much about Jews from other parts of the country. If your father came from Bialystok in 1905 and you were a kid soldier in the army in 1917, 1918, okay, well, did you know much about Reform Jews living in Alabama or Mississippi or, the far west? You didn't know anything about them. And did you know about Reform Judaism? You figured it was treif. So American Jews, especially traditional ones from the East Coast cities and especially New York, now were able to interact with other kinds of American Jews and realize that we have certain things in common and maybe certain things where we're different, but we're all American Jews together in this for one good cause. One of the things that ended up happening as a result of all this is that there were shiduchim, there were marriages that were made between traditional New York Jews and the daughters of Southern and Western Jews who were more assimilated. And sometimes these New York Jews would then not come back to New York, but rather settle down in the American South and the Midwest and West. And so there was a significant bump in Jewish population outside of the Northeast Corridor after World War I, when those soldiers just stayed back, down south and out west. Okay. Was there conflict between the clergy? The answer is that there were times when the Catholics and the Jews got together against the Protestants because they felt that the Protestants were muscling them out of any and all power, that the Protestants felt that America was a Protestant country and they deserved to be the bosses of all religious affairs of the army, and that the lesser religions like Catholicism and Judaism have no place. So the two would band together against the bossing and domineering Protestants. There were other times when the Catholics and the Protestants banded together against the Jews, just out of old world anti-Jewish bigotry. And there were other times when it was the Jews and the Protestants against the Catholics. Okay, so all these permutations did exist. But the main thing is that clergy of different faiths had to learn to get along. They did, and as a result of that, you had in the 1920s and 1927, in particular, the establishment of the National Association of Christians and Jews. It's surprising that such an organization would even exist with that name. After all, the Jews are only 3% of the population, so why would you have to have a National Association of Christians, 97%, and Jews, 3%? Goes to show you that the experience of World War I led to this notion of a tripartite American religion, of Protestant, Catholic, Jew. So there is this notion that the Protestant, Catholic, Jew idea was a development of World War II. And we're going to discuss that at some length. We're going to review a book by Deborah Dash Moore called G.I. Jews. I'm sure some of you have read it already and have seen the movie. Maybe in about a month and a half from now, we'll discuss that. But that idea that it began in World War II is incorrect. Rather, World War II, you already had established concepts of the chaplaincy and of providing services for soldiers of various religious denominations, but that began in World War I and was actually quite successful in World War I. So, one last point about Jewish welfare and the like. So Jewish servicemen, were they looking for religious services to be provided to them in the army? The answer seems to be that whereas in World War II, you had many American Jews who were already thoroughly assimilated and needed to discover their Judaism in the army and their Jewish identity and the consequences of their identity while in the army. For World War I, that wasn't really the case. These were people who were new arrivals to America. Their Jewish identity was very much secure. It was just a question of would the United States cater to it or not. And so the historians basically come to this conclusion. The American government and the American army was not really interested in World War I in pursuing cultural pluralism or religious pluralism, lishma, for its own sake, as we would say, to use a Talmudic expression. It was not for its own sake, but rather they had to do so because they wanted to keep the draft going and keep the army cohesive. So for practical reasons, they had to cater to a certain degree of pluralism, even if conceptually they didn't even agree with it. But it was 100% necessary because America in 1917, 1918 had a very diverse population with diverse needs. And if you don't cater to those needs, you lose a significant chunk of your potential pool of soldiers. So this is the story of the Jewish Welfare Board and the chaplaincy and trying to make Jewish soldiers comfortable in their environment. Okay, let's now go to the issue of politics and where Jewish loyalties were in the war before America got involved. So early in the war, Jewish leaders feared that there would be manifestations of a breach in neutrality, that President Wilson had called upon the American people to be neutral in thought and deed, and it could very well be that Jews don't feel like they should be neutral. They have strong partisan opinions and nationalistic opinions one way or the other, and they might expose themselves and get the Jews in trouble. And what was President Woodrow Wilson's actual statement? It was a message on neutrality delivered on August 19th, 1914, 5 days after the war began. The United States must be neutral in fact as well as in name during these days that are trying men's souls. We must be impartial in thought as well as in action. We must put a curb upon our sentiments as well upon every transaction that might be construed as a preference of one party to the struggle before another. So this truth is it's baloney, because even Wilson himself wasn't impartial. Wilson was by sentiment very pro-British and anti-German, but he had to play the line of we're going to strike it down the middle. So there were many groups in the United States that had conflicting interests and rooting interests. There were the Jews, as I've mentioned, which at least early in the war might have been pro-German and anti-Russian. There were the Irish, who were anti-British. They were pro-German just because they hated the British and favored Irish independence. There were American blacks who were anti-German on the grounds that the Germans were committing atrocities in Africa or committing atrocities in Europe that were akin to the atrocities in Africa. There were the socialists who favored pacifism, and there were the Catholics who had Catholic considerations that were transnational. Okay, so German Americans, of course, were the most conflicted. They had to balance the desire to serve their fatherland, the United States, with their Vaterland, Germany, the old fatherland with the new fatherland. And in 1914 and through 1917, because America hadn't officially taken sides, America became a sort of a transnational space where different ethnic groups could pursue an agenda that was one or the other, but they ran the risk of offending the broader American population, which was at first neutral and then shifted towards pro-British. Okay, so the popular American notion among those who were longtime Americans was that Europe is a far way off. Europe is very far away, thousands and thousands of miles away. We have oceans that separate us. Who cares about what happens in Europe? Who won the ball game last night? Or rather, in the afternoon, there were no night games at that time. So that was your average American sentiment. But for those recently arrived groups who had family abroad, this was a real concern right away. Already from August of 14, people had a rooting interest. Louis Marshall, interestingly, was not pro-German. Jacob Schiff was pro-German. And he had to try to balance his instinctive pro-German sentiment with a need to shun the current German political state. Meaning, Jacob Schiff, who came to America as a fairly young man, having been born in Frankfurt, he loved the old, the concept of Germany, but he didn't love the political Germany of 1915. So he had to be able to bifurcate that. Whereas Louis Marshall, who was a German-American Jew, said, my family's experience in Germany was terrible. That's why they left. So I'm not going to be pro-German. So you could go either way. You could say, I used to live there. I loved it. Or I used to live there and I hated it. Okay. There were 3 million Jews living in America in 1914. And of course, they're not going to be of one opinion. There can be different perspectives. What about the big time rabbis? The big time rabbis. So Stephen Wise was a pacifist, But Stephen Wise was a smart guy. He knew where his bread was buttered, or where his matzah was buttered. And he realized that when America joined the war, he cannot maintain his pacifism. For all of his ideological zeal, as soon as Wilson entered the war, you support the American war effort. By contrast, Judah Magnus was a radical pacifist, and he maintained his pacifism even after American entry into the war, which got him investigated by the Justice Department. You know, that's a little dangerous. You know, once your country enters war, you got to go along for the ride. And if you don't, you may pay a price, a personal price. Gotthard Deutsch, who was a professor at Hebrew Union College in Cincinnati, took it even one step further. After America joined the war effort, so he refused in the presence of his students to acknowledge whether he was rooting for an American victory or a German victory. That's a chutzpah, but he was a professor at HUC and got away with it to an extent. Okay. Now, in 1914 and 1915, the United States was concerned with supposed German atrocities in Belgium, at Flanders Field, okay? So, the Germans are the bad guys, the Huns, they're evil. But American Jews were not focused on that at all. American Jews were focused on the fact that Russia was guilty of atrocities against Jews in Poland. And so there's a little bit of a conflict here. On the one hand, America is neutral, but we're shifting towards pro-British and pro-French because Germany is doing bad things. But American Jews are going to say, hey, but Russia is terrible. The Tsar is killing the Jews. So we can't go in that direction. We got to go in this direction. Okay. Henry Morgenthau Sr., who was the U.S. ambassador to the Ottoman Empire stationed at Constantinople, he was reporting back, hey, there are atrocities being committed by the Ottomans against Armenians and against Jews in Eretz Israel. Well, that would lead towards an anti-German stance, but Wilson was not yet ready for that. Wilson was still trying to claim neutrality, and so it was inconvenient. It was an inconvenient truth that the Germans' allies, the Turkish, were guilty of genocide. So it had to be brushed under the rug. This is the first but not the only example of the Armenian genocide not getting the full attention that it deserved. Okay, but other Jews in America took a pro-British perspective. Richard Gottheil, the son of the rabbi of Temple Emmanuel, Gustav Gottheil, he spied for the British. Okay, he was an Orientalist and he was a professor of Judaic studies and he spied for the British. The German ambassador in the United States was issuing propaganda saying, oh, don't listen to any of the Russian claims that the Germans are guilty of atrocities in the East. Rather, the Russians are guilty of atrocities in the East. So everybody's trying to say that the other side was guilty of atrocities. And therefore, you, the Jews of America, should support our team because the other side is the devil. American Jews, on the whole, in the beginning of the war, feared a fratricidal conflict in which Jew versus Jew and different armies are going to fight each other and shoot each other and say Shema Yisrael, one against the other. And so there was an early reason for pacifism, even if the sentiment among most Jews was anti-Russian and pro-Habsburg. Okay, so what happens next? Now, Wilson had this desire for neutrality, but of course, people had strong opinions. The notion that Russia bathes in Jewish blood was the dominant theme up until about the spring of 1915. In the spring of 1915, things would change. And let me explain why things would change. So before about May of 1915, you had the idea that the Central Powers were an emancipating force for Jews, and therefore they're good. They're the good guys. Also, sentiment was anti-French. Why was there American Jewish sentiment that was anti-French? Does anybody know? Why anti-French?
Dreyfus?
Dreyfus, correct. That the Dreyfus affair had not yet worn off, that there was still this notion that the French are not fans of the Jews and are our enemy. So if you combine anti-Tsarist, anti-French because of Dreyfus, pro-German and Austrian because of the Habsburgs monarchy being good to the Jews, so all these things, or at least the early phases of the war, could have led the Jews in a pro-Central Power direction. But things would eventually change. Why? So four things happened. One was German behavior. German behavior was not what it was anticipated to be. That's one point. Second, I'll explain how. Second point was a changing attitude of the Allies towards Jews themselves. Third was the collapse of the Tsarist regime. And fourth was a change in American attitudes more generally. All four of these factors caused a shift in public opinion among American Jews away from the Central Powers and towards the Allies. So what happened? In quick succession, three things happened. One was the sinking of the Lusitania in 1915. It happened at a time when there was also great Russian defeat on the battlefield. And also, Italy entered the war on behalf of the Allies. They abandoned the Central Powers. They had never really been part of the Triple Alliance, but they never joined the Central Powers and then changed teams completely and joined the Allies. So all these things happened around the same time. It led American Jews and American Italians to suddenly realize we got to take a pro-Allied approach. So after the sinking of the Lusitania, German Americans stopped being pro-German. At least they couldn't be vocally pro-German because, after all, Germany had done a horrible thing. So they kind of changed their tune. What was the general American attitude after the Lusitania sinking? So Theodore Roosevelt, former president, he said we have to sever diplomatic ties with Germany and build up our army and navy. So that's a pretty aggressive posture. William Jennings Bryan, the Secretary of State, said let's maintain neutrality. Woodrow Wilson took a middle ground approach of we're officially neutral, but we're going to veer towards an anti-German perspective just in case we need to enter the war. Now, of course, he wants to be able to say in a 1916 election campaign that he kept us out of war, but it was a big lie because he probably knew he was going to enter the war anyway. Okay, so around this time, you have the Gorlitz-Tarnow Offensive, which the Germans and the Austrians smash through Russian lines and take large swaths of the old Pale of Settlement. And Russians are on their heels. Tsar Nicholas II personally takes over the command of the army, something which he knew nothing about, which was a big disaster for him. It wasn't likely to go well. Mm-hmm. And so this was that if you want to pick the winner, you're not, you might want to pick the Germans, but on the other hand, if your reason for opposing Russia was because you opposed the Tsar, well, maybe the Tsar might be utterly defeated. And if the Tsar could be defeated and Russia could be democratized, then maybe siding with Russia in the long run is not a bad thing. Okay, so the Germans did not treat the Jews very well. It was assumed incorrectly that upon German victory in the East, they would function as liberators and free the Ostjuden of the shackles of cruel Tsarist rule. But in reality, what actually happened was the Germans were as bad to the Jews as the Russians were. Why did this happen? So some would say because the Germans are horribly bigoted and they hate the Jews and it's a precursor to the Nazi Holocaust. Mm-hmm. But that's not necessarily the correct interpretation. Another interpretation is the Germans just didn't know what to do with these Ostjuden. They never the Ashkenazic Jews of the Pale did not speak German. They were backward. They were religious or they were socialist, and the Germans just had no clue how to handle these people. So in the end, they didn't do anything favorable. They didn't do horrible or totally murderous, but they didn't serve in the favorable capacity that people thought they might. Okay, so this led some Jews to turn away from Germany, to turn away from the Central Powers and say, you know what? They're not the good guys. They're not going to help us. We got to turn to the Allies. Well, what about the Allies? So the Allies started to look a lot better for a few reasons. Mm-hmm. One was Zionism. Herbert Samuel in 1914 had already written The Future of Palestine. And he wrote it as a member of the British cabinet. And he was the only Jewish member of the British cabinet, and the British didn't control Palestine at the time. It was still Ottoman. So for him to say the future of Palestine as a British official was a little presumptuous on his part, but it was an indicator that the British are thinking along the lines of dismembering the Ottoman Empire and taking bits and pieces of it for itself, including Palestine. It should be noted that when the war broke out, nobody actually was thinking of dismembering the Ottoman Empire. It was thought that, yeah, it's a sick man of Europe or a dying man of Europe, and it's not long for this earth, but there was no intention to destroy it. But as the war developed, it became more and more of a realistic possibility. And how do you justify an attack on the Ottomans? Well, we have an agenda of Zionism for the Jews. So Eretz Yisrael becomes an important part of the strategic calculations of World War I. Who else was looking better and better in the eyes of the Jews as the war went along? France. So France, as I said, was seen as hostile to Jewish interests for a long time because of Dreyfus. But in 1917, Clemenceau becomes the prime minister of France. And Clemenceau was pro-Dreyfus. He was one of the handful of French politicians and public intellectuals who called for a new trial for Dreyfus, at which he was acquitted. Okay, and also, Clemenceau was anti-clerical. If there was a reason why Jews in France or thinking about France had some hesitation, it's because of the Catholic aspect of the country. Well, Clemenceau was anti-clerical and not anti-Catholic, but favored a secular France, and that's music to the ears of French Jews. Okay, he also favored a Jewish home in Palestine. So we see that there was a convergence of Jewish and allied interests, that now the allies, the British with Zionism, the French with Clemenceau, and even the Russians, potentially in a post-Tsarist Russia, might be the good guys against the Central Powers that are not treating us so well. Okay, so therefore, in America, it became popular to think that you could be a patriotic American, but also be a Zionist for the other beleaguered Jews who need to move to Palestine. So if you remember, last week we discussed Brandeis and American Zionism. One of the reasons why Zionism is so successful organizationally during the war is because now there's a real perceived need for the success of Zionism, that refugees, Jewish refugees from the former Pale of Settlement and throughout Eastern and Central Europe need to go somewhere. And that somewhere could be Eretz Yisrael. It's not necessarily going to be Western Europe or the United States, especially if the gates are closing. So they got to go somewhere. So it's okay to be an American Jew who supports Zionism, because after all, what is it? It's one Jew giving money to a second Jew to move a third Jew to Palestine. That's American Zionism. We're not going to go ourselves. So after all, America's the golden of Medina. We're not moving, but we'll help somebody else get to Palestine. And that is a significant part of World War I and the American Jewish attitude towards World War I, that now this is an opportunity to solve the problems of the Ostjud. Okay. Now, when the Tsar abdicated in 1917, this changed everything. Because now Russian democracy, led by the Kerensky regime, could be the solution to the problems of the Jews of Eastern Europe. Jewish leaders now favored a Russian victory. It was 180-degree about-face, that before they wanted a Russian defeat to get rid of a wicked monarch. Now it's have a Russian victory because the good guys are in control. So if Russia could emerge from the war as a democratic state, and if Germany also could emerge from the war as a democratic state, meaning if the Kerensky regime could win, and that's democratic, and defeat the Kaiser, which was not so democratic, and replace it with a Germany which was more democratic, then really World War I would be the war to end all wars, on the premise that democracies don't go to war with fellow democracies. This was the thinking that was animating the change of attitude in 1917. Of course, all this becomes a moot point when what happens? When what happens? The Soviet takeover, the Bolshevik Revolution. So once the Bolsheviks are in charge and Lenin makes a separate peace and the Russians are out, so this whole theory collapses and there is no solution to the problems of the Ostjuden. Rather, they're trapped behind an iron curtain or, in democratic, pseudo-democratic states of East Central Europe in the interwar period. American Jews realized that their American and Jewish identities were aligned, as I said, and it was okay to be very patriotic in the American sense, red, white, and blue, and still project outwardly your parochial Jewish interests on the premise that there was no conflict between them. You know, whereas previously it might have been disconcerting to be an open Jew while trying to profess American patriotism, so now that's not a problem. They're not in conflict with each other. Okay, so ultimately then we can say that Jewish views in America came to mirror those views of Americans more generally. That when the war began, there was a healthy dose of pacifism among the broad swath of Americans and among some Jews. And while, yes, early in the war, there was a pro-Central Powers orientation by some Americans, notably of German extraction, and some Jews because of whatever sentiments that Jews had, eventually there was overwhelmingly pro-Allied support among the general American population and among the Jewish population for reasons of broader citizenship and because Jewish interests were allied with the Allies. Okay, questions. I'll take questions before I want to do a few other topics. Yeah, questions.
Read.
Start again.
In the books I've read.
Yeah.
During World War II, the Jews were taken by surprise because they remembered the Germans being nice to them.
Okay, so it happens to be the case that in certain parts of Poland and Lithuania, there was a positive reception by the Jews of the arriving German forces, and that the German forces did them some small favors. That yes, there were places, distinct places, where the arrival of German forces was a good thing, but it wasn't always true, and in fact, in some places, it was really bad. So where it was remembered that the Germans were so-called liberators, that's where World War II caught them by a measure of surprise. Although, to be honest, it should not have, because Nazism since 1933 had been horrifically anti-Jewish. So anyone who was trying to remember a positive moment in 1915 and projected onto 1939, 1940 was doing themselves a disservice. And such people probably didn't make it out alive from the war. Okay, it was a question in the chat. Asher says, it's interesting that the British hedged their bets, unsure of American Jews' sentiment, and might have introduced the Balfour Declaration in order to support their influence. So yes, so it is commonly thought that the British were looking for the support of the American Jewish community in getting the American government to be more aggressively prosecuting the war effort. And so to do that, they offered the Balfour Declaration. There is an element of truth to that. It's not the only reason. It's far from even being the first reason for the Balfour Declaration's issuance on November 2nd of 17. The main reason was just to provide a cover for the justification of dismembering the Ottoman Empire and giving some political excuse to take territory. It was also because there was a fear that the Germans would do it also, that the Germans were looking very favorable with the Jews. They might issue some sort of a German Balfour Declaration. Okay, there's a question from Dr. Haft. Did the alignment of Americanism and Judaism lead to the weakening of Jewish socialists? So the answer is yes. The answer is definitely yes. Jewish socialism will continue to exist through the middle 20th century, all right, and including Jews who supported the Soviet Union even after World War II, and including the Rosenbergs and that whole era of McCarthyism. But for Jewish socialism as a political force died in the early 1920s. And one of the reasons that it died, aside from the fact that Jews were making it in America and didn't, usually socialists are only voting along those lines because they're still working class and poor. But once you achieve a measure of success, you run away from that as far as you can. But the other factor is patriotism. During the war, we fight as a capitalist country and as patriotic soldiers fighting for a capitalist society. And so it's not so easy to sustain socialist attachment after you've done that. So World War I does play a significant role, but Uncle Sam is not a Red. Uncle Sam is Uncle Sam. Okay, did the Jewish community in Europe recover after World War I?
Not really.
Good question. And the answer is that it depended upon in which country you found yourself after the war ended. If you found yourself in the Soviet Union, then you were stuck. It was hard to get out. And although the Soviet Union catered to Jewish interests with the Evseksiya in the 1920s, by the time Stalin took complete power, ousting Trotsky and really being the dominant force in Soviet political life, so then every Jewish form of expression was totally suppressed and it was a disaster. if you lived in Poland or you lived in Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, Czechoslovakia, so then you were in a new supposedly democratic country, and those democracies did not always last very long, although Czechoslovakia lasted until 1938. Poland basically went autocratic by the mid-1920s. So those communities did reasonably well, but they suffered from anti-Semitism, especially in Romania and then in Hungary and then in Poland. So there was a brief flourishing of Jewish life in the 1920s, but by the 1930s, it was pretty bad again. Okay, there was another question. One second, the chat. There was a question from Paul about the influenza pandemic on the Lower East Side. So it's true, it was not good to live in close quarters, you know, in the tenements of the Lower East Side when a pandemic was raging. This was a reason why a significant number of New York Jews, and probably in other major cities as well, wanted to move out to get fresh air. There was this notion of fresh air. Where do you get fresh air? So some said the Bronx you could get fresh air, the East Bronx, you know, it wasn't as crowded. Others say go to the farmlands of Eastern Brooklyn, in other words, East New York, City Line area, which was really farmland before the 1920s. But other people said go to Arizona, in other words, get way out of New York, you go far, far away. But yes, health considerations played a role in 1918, 1919 in further reducing and dramatically reducing the total Jewish population of the old first areas of settlement immigrant quarters. Yes, that's a good question.
Excuse me.
Next question.
Also, you speak about the segment of Europe, but I think the nations like France and especially England needed to have a security around that area because of the Suez Canal.
Say that again, Tina. Couldn't hear you.
The Suez Canal was very important.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And the Ottoman Empire was right there. You know, so I think they wanted to, you know, make their dominance known in that area. And they didn't care if the sick man of Europe, you know, passed.
Yeah, so French and British control of the Suez Canal, which they had from the time it was built, because they built it up until Nasser's nationalization in 1956, was an important feature in the British Empire and in French, you know, the British had controlled Egypt basically since the 1880s. It was nominally Ottoman, but really it was controlled by the British military. And so their Eretz Israel was basically to be expected, in my view. I can't imagine the way that the war would have played itself out with them not bothering to attack, especially how vulnerable Ottoman regions were, since their army was pretty weak. Okay, so questions before I go on one more topic. Questions? Okay, so on the issue of World War One and American Jewry, so let's just talk about demographics. So because immigration came to a halt, yet your American Jewish community was stuck on about 3 million people at 1914 through about 1918, 1919. Immigration would pick up after the war among those who were able to get out. And it would be fairly substantial up until about 1924. At which point the restrictive immigration laws really kicked in. And at that point, the quotas were very low. And this leads to a small trickle of immigration in the 1920s and 1930s, at a time when Jews are trying to get out of Nazi Europe. And we're going to spend a couple of sessions on the issue of American Jewish immigration laws as they disadvantage Jews during the Nazi era. So. Back at home. So American Jewish life was affected by war experience in that, religiously speaking, those who go off to war sometimes don't come back with their religious scruples intact. World War One turned many people into atheists. Okay, I'm here at Anshi Shalom in New Rochelle, and one of our illustrious members or former members used to tell me that my father was a big Zionist, but he became an atheist because of World War One. Actually, I have two members of Anshi Shalom who told me that. One is and maybe listening tonight, and another member who's a former member of ours who said, yeah, World War One was so disastrous, we lost our faith in. Mm-hmm. So why did this happen? Well, the answer is, when you see trench warfare, people dying in such tremendous numbers, it's hard to maintain one's faith. Mm-hmm. And how does that affect religious life afterward? Is that not everyone is interested in synagogue-based religious life. Mm-hmm. They may be Jewish life. They may be interested in secular forms of Jewish identity. What kind of secular forms of Jewish identity exist? So one is you just become a secular Zionist. That's one option. Another is if you remained a socialist, you could become, instead of a traditional believing socialist, an atheistic socialist. Ultimately, you just believe in American Jewish secular culture, if such a thing could exist, mm-hmm. devoid of synagogue life. The synagogue need not be the locus of American Jewish existence, but rather some other fraternal organization can serve that purpose. Mm-hmm. So you have to bear in mind that while wartime can make people more religious, they can see the light, they can see, they can find in human suffering some spiritual cause, others will find the exact opposite. They'll run away from religion completely. Okay, that's one point. Mm. One point I want to make for tonight about Jewish communal life as a result of war is that the Jewish community became more democratically oriented, whereas previously the Jewish community allowed the machers, the wealthy elite, to dominate the shtadlanut, mm-hmm. The politicking, the lobbying on behalf of Jewish interests. If World War One was supposed to be a war that made the world safe for democracy, then American Jewish life also needed to be more democratic. Mm-hmm. That meant that the old AJC, the old American Jewish Committee, could no longer dominate the scene and had to give way to other organizations that allow for voting and real participation by the masses. And so I mentioned in the past, the American Jewish Congress, that the American Jewish Congress was supposed to be a democratically elected body to defend the interests of the Jewish people and represent American Jewry at the Paris Peace Conference of 1919. And it did more than that. It lasted, you know, long-term to be a more democratic representation of a diverse American Jewish community. So, you know, people would like to have a say over ethnic politics, and sometimes it's not easy to come about that democratic say in ethnic politics because moneyed interests and moneyed elite don't easily give up their sway and the influence that they have. But it is true that over time, the American Jewish the American Jewish body politic did become more democratic. And this would manifest itself not only in 1918, 1919, but would again manifest itself during World War II in the American Jewish Conference of 1943 and even beyond, that we like to elect our representatives, not just have somebody appoint themselves as I'm your leader. We don't go for that here in the United States. Okay, on that note, we'll call it quits for tonight. And next week, we'll discuss anti-Semitism that emerges after World War One into the 1920s and how that affects anti-immigrant sentiment and legislation. Take care, everybody.
Thank you.